Welcome, welcome to the Wheelhouse. You know, there's nothing more pathetic, nothing in the world more pathetic than a baby boomer who staggers into work all bleary-eyed because he was out at the Steely Dan concert last night. But that's me, and I'm so embarrassed. No, there would be something more pathetic if I'd been at Prairie Home Companion last night and I was really tired. That would be more pathetic, but I promise you that will never happen. Wild horses, etc. This is Colin McEnroe. John Dankowski's not here today. I can't say much about it. Yesterday, a private plane dispatched by David Cameron arrived and flew Mr. Dankowski to Scotland, where he will be playing a pivotal role in the 11th hour negotiations. I can't say anything else about it. It's history, though. History is being made over there. So I'm doing my best to fill in for him. And to do my best, I had to recruit the best. Keith Faniff is here from the Connecticut Mirror. Daniela Altomare from the Hartford Current. They are both fabulous. As we go along here today, we're going to be talking a little bit later about the 5th Congressional District race. That would be the one pitting Mark Greenberg against Elizabeth Esty. We'll also be talking about a transportation forum. There's nothing more exciting, really, and sexy than a transportation forum. But this one was really interesting, actually. The gubernatorial candidates were there. Both Keith and Daniela were there. And sometimes it's hard to find sharp etched differences between Dan Malloy and Tom Foley. But I think they really leapt out at that one. Also, as we go along here, we'll talk a little bit more generally about the gubernatorial race and about I just sort of have this question. Are we all of the press falling down on the job a little bit in our lack of interest in some of the under-ticket races? These would be things like attorney general, comptroller, secretary of state, treasurer. You could win money in bars by challenging people to name the Republican candidates. I, however, could win money from you if you did that with me. I can name them all, and I'm so proud about it. Also, just towards the end here, a new note of volatility has jumped into the baseball stadium situation in Hartford. This morning, we're told that the Minnesota Twins, at least – it might be too extreme to say that they're breaking up with the Rockettes, but they do want to date other people. Anyway, we'll tell you more about that and what its implications are as we go along here. We're going to start out with the trial of John Rowland. I can almost promise you that from now on, the Wheelhouse will not talk about John Rowland's trial because it's going to be over. And anyway, there's no Wheelhouse next week. But we do have to talk about it now. We want to talk about it now. Joining us right now is somebody who's been following it, and that is Jim Bergen, a lawyer from Shipman and Goodwin who has been following the Rowland case. He's also a former prosecutor. He's worked both sides of this aisle. So, Jim Bergen, first of all, welcome to the Wheelhouse.
Glad to be here.
And so yesterday we had a little bit of what was described as drama, although if you watch Law and Order or something, it might not be that exciting. But there was a conversation that went or a debate that went on about what seems to be the primary defense witness for John Rowland. And this would be, to set the stage, the question, the sort of primary question of this case seems to be, did he have a real job with the Lisa Wilson Foley campaign that was dressed up? That was hidden. It was made to look like he had a job with Apple Rehab, the company owned by her husband. Did that job with Apple Rehab even exist? Did he really do anything of any consequence? For the most part, the testimony of Apple Rehab employees have been, no, we didn't even know he was even allegedly doing anything. It caught us by surprise. But yesterday, there was a witness who was prepared to say that, no, this was a real job. And then there was some question that went on that only a keen legal mind like yours, Jim, would understand about whether that witness should be allowed to say everything that he wanted to say. Can you shed some light on that?
Well, first of all, he absolutely has to be able to testify. And the only thing the judge did yesterday was confine maybe 3% of what he's been testifying about. And Colin, you just mentioned that there were a number of employees that testified. Well, they didn't know anything that Rowland did. Earlier in the case, the government primary witness, Brian Foley, made a lot out of the fact, I got 5,000 employees and only 12 of them did anything to do with the campaign. And so it's plain that they could probably bring up, 4,500 and whatever employees that had nothing to do with Rowland, and that doesn't say anything. What they had yesterday was the CEO. The CEO actually worked with Rowland considerably and said that he thought that it was serious, and never for a moment did he think that he was not actually employed. Now, the problem with the government is this doesn't help them. Their whole theory that you've articulated well, which is that job was a ruse for him to be a paid employee of the campaign, It just doesn't hold up if the jury believes the CEO, who frankly is testifying against the interests of the owner of the company right now. So it does seem to bear credibility. He gets nothing out of this. He's just telling his version of his experience. And he said, hey, this guy, he worked. And in fact, I thought he was potentially going to take over my job. I didn't know what was going on. So the idea that Roland didn't think he was actually being paid for work is a very, very hard thing to prove. The real problem in this case, and only an NPR could give the time necessary to sort this out, is that we have one constitution. We have two systems, a political and a justice. The political system, the First Amendment says, is a free-for-all. Anybody can feel strongly about anything. In fact, I'm allowed to presume you're guilty. You're allowed to presume I'm guilty because, you know, we're supposed to take that out at the ballot box and the competition of ideas. In fact, I'm a lifelong Democrat, but I understand this separate system called the justice system. The justice system is predicated on the notion that our society is founded on liberty. Free people have to have these arguments, after all. And therefore, we're not going to take someone's liberty unless they're beyond a reasonable doubt guilty of something. Now, you have to, therefore, presume innocence. In the political system, you can presume guilt. The government is doing great work in what I would say is a really tough case. The only advantage the government has, and it's a big one, is that everybody presumes Roland guilty. If you presume him guilty, you know, everything you're going to hear, everybody knows about confirmation bias, is going to tend to prove, yep, he's guilty, see that, he's guilty. But if on the opposite, you presume him innocent, then what's happened is the same constitution acknowledges in both systems, everybody's got to work for a living. And the political system says anybody can volunteer for anybody. And Roland's entire life, according to the evidence, he's volunteered like mad. And volunteers have, in fact, won campaigns for people working their butt off. The fact that somebody wants to volunteer like they have their whole life, and whatever you think of Roland, and again, I'm a lifelong Democrat, but everybody admits the guy is very talented. And he should be able to use his talent freely. If he wants to volunteer for Foley, Wilson Foley, he should be able to do that all he wants. And as long as his mind, he's getting paid simultaneously for something he's actually doing, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Now, the government's done a great job with this presupposition that it was all designed to avoid campaign finance laws, disclosure laws. But if you think about Roland's position, what does he care about campaign finance laws? That's not his job. And, in fact, Brian Foley specifically hired Patton Boggs and Bloat in order to give an opinion on it, and Roland even saw that, and the opinion said this is perfectly fine. In other words, that aspect of it was all up front. Yep, I'm going to work over here, and I'm going to volunteer over there. And the fact that he may have volunteered 10 times as hard as he worked is really not relevant. If he worked and he earned what he earned, which, by the way, in the big picture, is chump change. For a guy like Brian Foley, $35,000 for Roland to come over and work with the CEO, that's chump change. He paid the same amount, if not more, to Tommy Ritter to do lobbying.
Although
so these
Jim,
people who are talented, they're worth something.
Jim, it does appear, you know, some things that maybe sort of fly a little bit in the face of what you're saying. I mean, first of all, there's volunteering and then there's running a campaign. And it's clear from some of the testimony that for much of this campaign, John Roland was essentially running it. He was present every day. He was signing off on every major decision.
Why do you say that somebody doing very vigorous stuff and very important stuff by definition is no longer a volunteer?
Well, I've covered a lot of congressional campaigns, Jim. I've never seen a volunteer in that role before. In other words, when you get to the level of congressional campaigns, you have paid staff who run the campaign day to day and make all the major decisions. You don't let volunteers do it.
My experience, I mean, it goes way back, and yours is a whole lot more than mine. I worked on the Carter reelection campaign in 1980, and they had Schultz, who basically was really important to the running of that campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you bring in somebody on the top, they did not have him, you know, licking envelopes. They had him giving strategic vision.
No, but Carter was paying him through his peanut farm. So no, that's just a joke. That's not true.
But the point is that no matter how important Roland was to the campaign, if he's doing the stuff he does and he does it well and he feels like doing it, he's allowed to do it. Sure, he'd love to get paid, but he was toxic. He was radioactive. So he says, all right, fine. I won't be a paid employee, but I still believe in you, and I still want you to win, so I'm going to do what I can do. But I'm working. He had another job, you know. He was on the radio. He had another job. But it wasn't like full-time. It was very valuable. But the fact that it's valuable doesn't make it payable.
Now, the government did try to use sort of big data to counteract this a little bit and say, well, look, you know, we can sort of look at the amount of work that he did. We can even quantify it in terms of emails and stuff like that. And, you know, it's 10 to 1 the other way.
What's that? What does that prove, Colin?
Well, I mean, because I guess I'm asking you that. I'm asking you.
A very vigorous volunteer.
Yeah. I guess I'm asking you that. Does it matter? Is it likely to matter to a jury in weighing this question? Was this a real job with a nursing home company and a lot of very vigorous and enthusiastic, as you say, volunteering on the side? Or was this kind of a nominal, you know, turn on the light switch job with a nursing home company that was a cover? And
it's very effective evidence, Colin. You're absolutely right. It's very effective. And it's particularly effective with all those people that presume guilt.
Mm.
But it's not in and of itself logically relevant. I mean, I do a lot of volunteer work. I probably 1,000 hours a year I'm doing bar stuff and training and all that sort of thing. I don't get paid for that. But if you stack that up as against one case where I might spend 20 hours but my billing rate's very high, you're going to say, well, geez, was that one case that you worked on, was that a ruse? No, that was my case. That's what I got paid for. So as long as he was legitimately getting paid $35,000, the fact that he may have spent $350,000 worth of free work, on the other hand, doesn't really mean anything unless you presume him guilty. If you presume him guilty, then you're going to say, you see, it's all a ruse.
Jim Bergen, last question for you. The prosecution, the government, put on a pretty exciting array of witnesses, a Rabelaisian cast of witnesses ranging from former candidates like Andrew Rohrbach and Mark Greenberg to, you know, all kinds of people. Now, it seems like a rather limited cast on the defense side. In fact, Keith Faniff's colleague Mark Pazniokas has just tweeted, former Governor John G. Rowland just told the judge he will not testify in his own defense. That's not a big surprise. But are you surprised by how small the number of defense witnesses is, or is that kind of standard operating procedure in a case that's unfolding this way?
No, it's standard operating procedure because, frankly, the witnesses that they called were subject to cross-examination, and Rowland's lawyers were able, generally speaking, to bring out what they had to bring out. And the witness that they've put prominent is really the most important witness, the guy who says, look, I'm the CEO. I make all the decisions here, and I thought the whole time that the guy was working with me. I never for a minute thought it was a fraud. So if that is believed, then he wins. The jury would have to essentially say unanimously, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the CEO lied, when in fact the CEO, when he says this, is testifying against his own interests because he's basically annoying his boss, the owner of the company. So honestly, I really don't know which way this is going to come out because I don't know how these jurors feel, but I can tell you the government's done a great job putting on a very persuasive case. That's a very hard case.
Mm-hmm. And so I said with last question, one more question. So, I mean, things that are to come will be summations and then instructions from the judge. How much weight do you put on those things?
Oh, a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, because the judges, you know, different judges have, it's more than just the literal words that are expressed, it's how they do it and the emphasis, because the transcript that goes to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals does not reveal the pace, does not reveal the emphasis, and so I think jury instructions are very, very important. Most jurors really take their responsibility very seriously. So if they're following the presumption of innocence, for example, I mean, I would imagine the lawyer in his argument, the defense lawyer, is going to say, look, assume that you're an honest person, and honestly, you have to admit that you presumed him guilty. Now you have to do your sworn obligation and do the opposite. That's part of the argument. That's part of what you have to do. So the argument and the jury instructions are very important.
All right. Jim Bergen, if I get caught in one of these situations, you're my first call based on what I heard today.
And you know what, Colin? That actually seems potentially productive.
All right. Thanks. From Shipman and Goodman, that's Jim Bergen. Better call Jim if you're in that kind of trouble. So maybe we should just jump from there. I don't know if you guys had anything more that you wanted to say about this case. I mean, except that there's sort of an interesting way that it casts a little shadow over these other actual races that are going on right now. And Daniela, I know you've been there in the 5th where Mark Greenberg is running against Elizabeth Esty. He actually was a key figure earlier in this case. He testified in this case. This whole case is about how things happened, not only in the last cycle in the 5th Congressional District, but even in the cycle before that, which is the 2010 cycle, which is when Greenberg says he was approached by John Rowland about such a scheme. First of all, if you're out in the 5th, are people talking about the John Rowland case or are they talking about the race?
Everybody's paying attention for sure. Mark Greenberg's testimony was really interesting because he did give him a showcase. You know, he is a candidate now. He talked a little bit about who he was, and he mentioned his animal shelter up in Bloomfield. And, you know, I was talking to Paz about it afterwards, and Paz said, you know, the jury just sort of responded to that. Like, people were like, wow, that's interesting. And then you saw him put out an ad a week or so ago that sort of highlighted his animal shelter, his work. I mean, that's a story that I don't think he's told very well in the past campaigns, and maybe that's going to move a little more front and center. Sort of telling a little bit more about who he is. I think in the past, the Democrats were effective in just sort of dismissing him as a Tea Partier or as a right winger whose, you know, values aren't really in line with some voters in Connecticut. But I think he's starting to turn that around, and he's got Esty on the defensive on a bunch of things as well. So.
And we'll come to that in a second. But, you know, Keith Faniff, one of the things that did emerge when Greenberg testified that I think we sometimes hear in the press forget is he talked about his interactions with John Rowland and how they were tinctured a little bit by just the adulation that's heaped on John Rowland. And, you know, I think he describes being at the Prescott Bush dinner or something like that and just watching Rowland just be mobbed, you know, by admirers, which made it harder for him to say, blow it out your old wazoo, you can't work for my campaign. That's actually not his exact words. But and we forget that sometimes. I mean, I've been told by other people about funerals that John Rowland shows up at where he can barely find a place in the pew because he's just being treated like Peyton Manning coming back to Indianapolis or something. We sort of forget that he's not held in disfavor by everybody.
I think there's a lot of that. I think the media is guilty of that sometimes too. We're talking about somebody who won two statewide contests for governor, both of them by wide margins, one by a very
– Three actually, but who's counting?
Substantial. Excuse me. You're absolutely right. Three. Boy, that's
– It's early.
I didn't even go to the Steely Dan concert.
Yeah.
I'm sorry about that. Well, it proves
you were
my
in a
point.
Punk, you were in a punk club all that, night.
That
we understand.
That people forget them. But no, absolutely. I think there is that factor out there, and especially in certain parts of Connecticut, I suspect the former governor is still very well received.
Yeah, and you can sort of look at it as we of the press don't get it, or you can look at it as there's a tremendous amount of enabling that's gone on about this guy that maybe even has allowed him to take some of his past transgressions less seriously. I mean, if people are constantly pounding you on the back and saying, hi, Johnny, and treating you like QB1, you know, it's hard for you to maybe understand that you did something bad a while ago. I want to just come back to this 5th District race. One of the things we don't have, Daniela, correct me if I'm wrong, we don't seem to have a poll here, right?
No, I don't believe Quinnipiac polls in the congressional races, at least not that I recall. And I think it's something to do with the size and margin of error and things like that. There may be other polls. There certainly is partisan polling going on behind the scenes, but there's nothing firm that we can sort of cling to.
And, you know, somebody called me from a national publication yesterday or 2 days ago and said, well, is this a real race? And I said, you know, because there's no poll, I don't know. But I think we have to assume that it's fairly competitive, right?
I think it's getting more competitive. I think initially, you know, again, you look at a guy who's run twice before and you say, oh, he couldn't do it, you know. But the dynamics this time around are very different. There was no primary. You know, Elizabeth Esty is in her first term. And if she's going to get picked off, as we all know, that this is the time, right? I mean, this is when incumbents are most vulnerable. After that, especially in congressional races, it becomes very, very difficult. I mean, you look at the guy up in Massachusetts who, you know, had all kinds of baggage and finally he lost a primary. But, I mean, it's just very challenging to pick off incumbent congresspeople.
Also, it's the 6th year of the Obama presidency. Mm-hmm. That's the year typically where the president's record is the most damaging to anybody from his party who's
running. Exactly. And she's also running on the ballot with Malloy. And that, you know, some people argue that could hurt her as well.
Some people do argue that. I want to ask you just oddly enough, the headlines out of this race rather than being about some of the things you might expect, economic malaise, which we'll talk to Keith about in a second, have been, I mean, a lot of sort of charges and countercharges. Mm-hmm. In particular, SD has tried to make some hay, first of all, about Greenberg's appearance at the Roland trial, even though, mm-hmm. I mean, he's sort of the guy who turned Roland down. And then about this, his attempt to use as a talking point the beheading of one of the American journalists by ISIS. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so that was an interesting thing because he did put out a press release. This journalist, Stephen Sotloff, the second reporter killed in Syria, was a graduate of a private school in the Fifth District in Washington. So Greenberg sent out an email, and, you know, as part of that email, there was the standard, you know, donate here button, which, you know, many of the candidates have. But she took tremendous offense at that and held several press conferences and issued several press releases about this, or maybe one press conference, but a bunch of press releases, criticizing him for that and saying it was in poor taste. And she brought out a veteran to say, you know, he was offended as well, a veteran who was actually a Democrat and a supporter of hers. So it turned into this little, you know, this sort of little issue. And Greenberg pointed out, you know, this was a standard thing, and SD herself has those buttons on her website and, you know, on her campaign literature. It's tricky. I mean, I think there were some issues with Blumenthal after Sandy Hook. He sent out a press release saying, you know, vote for me and, you know, you'll get – or not vote for me, but give the Democrats money or something like that because we need strong gun laws and the Newtown tragedy and that kind of thing. And he got some pushback from that as well.
She took great offense at it, either that or she took great delight in having something to take a great defense offense at. We'll never know what goes on inside there. Keith, you know, I'm surprised that the economy isn't a bigger issue, that I'm not hearing that more in this race. But one feels that it's a low, semi-audible hum in every race in Connecticut and that incumbents, therefore, run the risk of being blamed for just that general sense of malaise that seems to be pervading Connecticut.
I'm going to steal a line from my colleague Mark Pasniokas. Paz loves to talk about the conspiracy of silence. Mm-hmm. Here's the problem. Without getting into all the numbers, we know about the sluggish economy. We know there's a sizable deficit in the state budget. But we have two gubernatorial candidates who both keep rolling out tax cuts. They don't want – I mean, Governor Malloy's position is basically there really is no deficit. Tom Foley's position is, oh, the deficit's very real, but not in any way will it stop me from doing all the tax relief that I want to do right off the bat. Mm-hmm. So both of them are more focused on, to a certain extent, minimizing for different reasons the discussion of the sluggish economy and focusing on what they want to do because neither one can really accomplish – you can certainly question whether either can accomplish what they're promising to do.
And you wonder – we're going to have to wrap up here, Daniela, but you wonder whether that really sort of bears on a congressional race, whether or not the economy and particularly a specific state economy can wash up on the face on the feet of an incumbent like SD. On the other hand, you know, Congress people are supposed to bring jobs and deliver pork and all that stuff.
Yeah. And I think the Fifth District traditionally struggles a little bit more than other parts of the state regarding, you know, unemployment and things like that. But international issues play a huge role, will play a huge role in that race with what's going on in Syria. And, you know, that's obviously not an issue in the governor's race. So.
Absolutely not. We're doing the Wheelhouse today. John Dankosky is on a secret mission to Scotland. I can't talk anything about it. We're also privileged to have in our studios with us our friends from CTN. So this show will be on CTN. I believe we're the lead-in to my favorite CTN program, Real Housewives of the Program Review and Investigations Committee. It's great, too. It's great. You should watch it. All right. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back with more. And we're back. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm Colin McEnroe sitting in for John Dankosky. Keith Faniff from the Connecticut Mirror, Daniela Altomare from The Current are with us. And one of their colleagues, in fact, Daniela's colleague, Chris Keating, has just tweeted that Governor Christie and Tom Foley will appear with baseball manager Bobby Valentine in Stamford on Tuesday. This is a flaw in the thinking of the Tom Foley campaign. When you surround yourself with famous people, you're supposed to pick ones that people like. Chris Christie and Bobby Valentine, much more problematic. Even in Stanford, where Bobby Valentine was briefly the – and I think he was for some nominal amount of money, he was the civil defense director of Stanford. And it was either Sandy or Irene, one of the hurricanes. He was asked if he would be staying there in Stanford to see the town, the city through this big hurricane. And he said – because he was scheduled to broadcast a game with ESPN – this was before he got the Red Sox job – he was scheduled to announce or broadcast an ESPN game, I think, in Texas that night. And he said it was a stupid question. Not meaning, of course, I'm going to stay in Stanford because I'm the civil defense director. It was a stupid question because, of course, he's going to go do the baseball game. Anyway, note to Tom Foley, pick more popular celebrities to hang around with. Chris Christie and Bobby Valentine, very problematic. All right. So if you're a journalist, a young, aspiring journalist, imagine the young, fresh-faced Keith Faniff or the young, equally fresh-faced Daniela Altamara. You think someday, if it all comes together for me, I'm going to be sitting there covering transportation forums and finding out what the candidates think about them. So for both of these fine journalists, and deservedly so, that dream came true earlier this week. And so, Daniela, take us on a journey to this transportation forum. What was it?
Well, it was not a debate because the candidates did not appear together. Tom Foley appeared first, and then the governor came. The governor spoke for a lot longer than Tom Foley did. But really, they talked about, the details of their transportation policy, but they also sort of provided a glimpse into their different campaign styles. We saw the governor in his typical, mode, with lots of facts and lots of figures and just, talking for a very long time. And we saw Tom Foley, do his thing, and the contrast was pretty sharp. So that was interesting in that way as well.
Well, Keith, at times during this race, there's been a temptation to say to oneself, well, in the words of Ralph Nader in 2000, there's not a dime's worth of difference between these two candidates. I think this was a time when that really seemed not to be true. I mean, it really jumped out to me anyway in reading yours and Daniela's coverage that as she's suggesting, Malloy had a lot to say about transportation. And Foley's grasp of this seemed a little shaky to me.
Keep in mind now you're about to hear a dissenting opinion from somebody who forgot how many terms John Rowland served.
All right.
But I have to respectfully disagree with you both.
Okay.
I think they were very much mirror images of each other. Governor Malloy, by the way, only spoke longer because he broke the format. They were supposed to give 15 minutes of opening remarks.
And several glasses.
And 15 minutes of comments. Mm. Tom Foley followed the rules. Governor Malloy spoke for about 3 minutes and ran out of prepared comments. Then when he answered all the questions they had also asked Tom Foley, he said, hey, how come I'm done quicker? Get me some more questions. So they made up some more and he kind of went on some political speeches on them. If you were measuring the details, neither one of them rolled out a lot for this reason. For the last decade, basically, two things have been going on with our transportation system. We're taking about 50% more from motorists at the pumps. And we've fallen way behind repairing everything. And neither one of these people can do anything more than say, trust me, I'm going to increase transportation spending. I'm going to fix it. But don't ask me how I'm going to pay for it. That's where I saw them as carbon copies.
But there was one stark difference in terms of the public transit. I think Malloy jumped all over Foley, because, again, it allowed
him. On the busway.
Exactly. And just on transit, public transit, transportation in general, mass transit in general, where, he was once again able to hammer this theme home that Tom Foley doesn't care about us. He doesn't take the bus. Does he know what a bus is? I mean, remember him asking that at the press conference afterwards. It's just this idea, once again, that Foley's this rich guy from Greenwich who, rolls up in his fancy car, doesn't understand, that workaday people take the bus or the trains in Fairfield County. And he just went on and on and on about that and gave him once again an opening to underscore his message that, Foley is this heartless businessman who just doesn't care.
That's fair. That was a classic verbal blunder on Tom Foley's part. I had asked him a question about what happens with the busway, and he started to analyze it and say, well, we've invested a lot in capital, so you wouldn't want to just toss that away. But then he thought about it and he said, well, we are going to be subsidizing the operation year after year. I'd be hesitant to do that if we keep having to spend too much money on a system nobody uses. And you could just, you know, by the time Governor Malloy got to respond to that, you could just see he was ready to tear into that one. Unfortunately, though, I think it took away from the bigger thing, which is forgetting the busway. The busway is not our transportation system. We have billions of dollars of projects where the state says, like things like the viaduct in Hartford, they have no clue where the money's going to come to pay for it. The advocates are basically begging these guys to say they're going to support tolls or raise taxes to pay for this. And both of them are saying, actually, I'm going to be cutting taxes. I talked to a lot of advocates afterward and said I didn't hear what I wanted to hear, busway comments aside.
I mean, I thought, and not having been there, just having read your excellent coverage, I was sort of astonished by Foley's general indifference to mass transit. I mean, at one point he appears to have said that, you know, he doesn't really believe in building more mass transit. He believes in expanding the size of roads. First of all, anybody who knows anything about transportation, and if Tom Condon were here, I mean, he would be happy to even share with me the term of art, which I've forgotten for it. But there's a term within transportation engineering for the fact that when you build another lane, basically it gets filled. In other words, the traffic comes – it's sort of the field of dreams concept of transportation. If you build it, they come. There'll just be more cars in that lane. The essential congestion of the highway system won't change measurably. I mean, it might change for a day or two, and then the cars figure out there's more room, and then they're there. That ultimately, if you really do want to change the way traffic moves around, you have to make it intermodal. You have to build different kinds of modes of transportation. Aside from the busway, of course, as I've pointed out many times, we basically have the same mass transit system here in Connecticut that Pete Campbell is taking in Mad Men, which is set in the 1960s. I mean, we basically don't build new mass transit here. It's been a mistake. And whenever we talk about luring new business here, we always talk about infrastructure. And part of infrastructure is the ability of people to get around. People don't want to move their business or their jobs to some place where it's difficult to move around. If you want to make it less difficult to move around, you really have to build intermodal transportation systems, which we sort of failed to do, you know, year after year after year. So to be in favor of an enhanced business climate but not believe in building more transportation systems seems to me to be an incompatible set of positions.
I completely agree. I think the problem is, without going too deep into the numbers, we actually have fewer DOT staff by about 10% than we had a decade ago. We have billions more in projects. We actually every year are now taking a couple $100 million of federal money and assigning it to future years because the DOT can't spend it fast enough. Mm-hmm. We have probably $3 billion of bonding. The state bond commission's approved. That we still haven't gone to Wall Street and actually borrowed the money because once we borrow it, shoot, we have to start paying interest on it and we don't have the money in the budget to pay interest on it. But it all looks good on piece of paper, like we've got all this money in play. It's sitting there. We actually have a system that's backlogged. That's the best way I can describe it. If we don't get that going, we're never going to get to the economic development enhancements. Fairfield County wants high-speed commuter rail. They want to shave 30 minutes off the ride to Manhattan. There's about $2 billion to $3 billion they say needs to be invested over the next 10 years. As soon as you look at that, the first thing they say is, oh, yeah, plus we need about $3 billion in basic maintenance first. We're not even close to any of that stuff.
Daniel, in terms of who is sitting out there in the audience, I'm assuming these were, for the most part, people who are advocates for enhanced transportation systems.
Yeah, I think it was a wide, coalition of different groups. One question that was asked was about climate change, mm-hmm. and the responses there were very interesting because neither of these guys really drew a direct connection. I mean, Foley basically just said, you know, I have faith that technology will, you know, take care of this, and you know, Connecticut shouldn't do anything on its own because you know we don't build cars here, so you know it's kind of out of our grasp. And Malloy started talking about, you know, coal-burning states and went on this long tangent that I couldn't quite grasp. So that was kind of interesting. There was really no mention of biking and walking and other forms of transportation like that. So I think, the conversation was kind of narrow in that sense.
Well, yeah. And a transportation policy that is keyed to climate change, that is reactive to climate change, essentially has to force people out of their cars and into some other form of transportation. I mean, that's the responsible thing to do. If you take climate change seriously, if you take greenhouse gas reduction seriously, there's no choice. I mean, that's really what you have to do. But we're back to the Pazniokistrom conspiracy of silence, Keith. Nobody really wants to talk about that.
No. And I just want to mention one other thing. Danielle and I were talking about this beforehand. There was one other little political nugget that came out of this that was kind of unusual. Governor Malloy talking about the future, whether he intended to or not, kind of left open the possibility that he might not win the race. Daniela can back me up on this and tell it better than I can.
Well, it was just interesting because, you know, oftentimes in these speeches, he does not come across as very reflective, or, you know, he just comes across as super confident. And, you know, and he did say, I think at least one or two times, you know, if I'm not here. And then he sort of concluded by talking about his mother and how his mother inspired him to always leave the world a better place. And, you know, that's his role in life. And you can't, you know, wait till the end to do it. You have to do it all along. And it was actually very, very interesting.
He said if he wasn't in office, the transportation projects that he's starting now will bear fruit in the future. He wasn't talking about passing on, but he was saying, if I'm not here, you'll still see my transportation legacy. And that was a little different to hear something like that.
Well, I mean that could also be as a way of introducing some urgency to the notion of him being here, right?
True.
Like if I start these transportation projects and they're good, you know, then you want me here to see them through. But if it's like a Tom Joad kind of speech, like, you know, wherever there's somebody building light rail from Springfield to New Haven, I'll be there.
That's
kind of depressing.
That wasn't it.
And then he concluded by saying, what's the use? It's all sex and food, hurtling towards a necropolis. Thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. No, he didn't say that. He hasn't gotten that depressed yet. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say on the mass transit thing, you know, I think Foley was trying to make a kind of a nuanced point that, you know, mass transit doesn't work for everybody, and that's true. And I think that kind of got lost a little bit. You know, it's hard to sort of make these kind of more nuanced points in this type of a forum and when he's, you know, surrounded by reporters afterwards and that, you know. But he basically was saying, you know, that we need to deal with, you know, traffic congestion has a very high human cost, and, you know, people are sitting in their cars. He always mentions the moms sitting in their cars and they're separated from the kids. He also mentioned the dads. And, you know, I think that's sort of what he was trying to get across.
We have a question on Twitter from DFA in New Haven. Why was biking and walking not mentioned at the transportation forum? Because we don't consider them transportation.
There were some environmental advocate groups there, so maybe they put those in questions that just never – they put questions on 3x5 cards and handed them into the moderator. Maybe those questions just didn't make it through.
It would be nice if they had been. All right. I think we should take a break. I know we should take a break. This is The Wheelhouse, John Dankosky, Secret Mission in Scotland. Can't be talked about. Coming back after this. Welcome back. This is The Wheelhouse. Keith Faniff from the Connecticut Mirror and Daniela Altomare from the Hartford Courant are joining me here in studio today. I'm Colin McEnroe. I'm guest hosting for John Dankosky. He's on a secret mission to Scotland, not Scotland, Connecticut, as Keith speculated during the break. No. All I can say about it is he's undercover in Scotland for the last week. He's been trying on kilts in his office, picking out, making sure he gets the correct Dankosky tartan. That's all I can say about this at this time. All right. So, I'd actually been talking to you about what we're going to talk about. I neglected to mention this, but you're going to do fine with it anyway. So some people on the right are calling for Joe Visconti, the third party candidate for governor, to get out of the race. I mean, people from the Tea Party are even saying he should get out of the race for governor. He's a spoiler. The music that we heard going out of the last segment was actually some very stirring music from his latest commercial, in which it appears that he's having a lot of fun. There's one thing I've never seen anybody have so much fun running for governor as Joe Visconti is having, which makes it seem to me, Daniela, unlikely that he's getting out of this race for anybody's sake.
He's insisting he's absolutely not getting out of this race. He's calling those people who are calling on him to get out. He's calling them basically traitors to the Tea Party ideals. He's definitely not getting out.
Why would he? He's having a great time.
He's very enthusiastic about it. Now, this might be one of the metrics I measure enthusiasm by, but my last interview with him, he showed up with a copy of the state budget under his arms. He'd been
doing
his homework.
That's such a suck-up move when you're talking to Keith Faniff.
It is.
It's such a suck-up move.
It shows how much he was into it. I agree with Daniela. He's enjoying running.
Joe has a background in drama, and, you know, it's very evident. I mean, the guy's just hysterical.
And if you look at the cue poll, too, he's not a non-factor. I mean, showing 7 points,
right.
I think, in the Q poll, that's not nothing in this race.
Absolutely not.
Showing 7 points in the Q poll and not hurting Foley is also kind of surprising.
Yeah, but I think the Tea Party types are very nervous because the one thing they don't want is another Malloy term. So they're, you know, looking at Joe as saying, get out, you know, and support Foley, get on board with him.
If you look at that metric in the Q poll where it's asked how many people were voting for Foley as an act of voting against Malloy, such a high number, I think it was 62%. So then you sort of look at that and you think, well, that could be read two different ways in terms of the effect somebody like Joe Visconti could have. It could split up the vote of people who are voting against Malloy. But, you know, everything about the Q poll suggested anyway Visconti wasn't really hurting Foley that much, and that some of Visconti's votes, I think 7% of the Democrats said they were voting for Visconti. So, I mean, some of his votes are coming from what would putatively be Malloy's base too. So.
Could be the Common Core folks, the anti-Common Core folks rather.
Right. That's what I was going to say. There are some people who are literally just looking to vote but launch a protest vote against the incumbent. So in this case, maybe those votes would have gone to John Pelto with him not on the ballot. They ironically go to someone who's probably politically the polar opposite of John Pelto.
But can't win and isn't Malloy and isn't Tom Foley.
Exactly.
Yeah. So he's a placeholder for all that discontent. All right. So one thing I wanted to bring up, and somebody messaged me about this yesterday, and I thought he had a good point, which is I'm going to say the following names, and I may mispronounce the first one of them. Kai Westby, Peter Lumage, Tim Herbst. And I'm so proud of myself for not having to look up this one. Sharon McLaughlin, I brought it up. I dragged it up out of some deep well of my memory. Those are all people who are Republican candidates, major statewide Republican candidates for office. They are all running for under-ticket positions as constitutional officers. Kai Westby, Attorney General, Tim Herbst for Treasurer, Peter Lumage for Secretary of State, and Sharon McLaughlin for Comptroller. However, I'm guessing many of you have never heard those names, or anyway, if I'd asked you to come up with those names, would have done not very well. If it had been your final wager on Jeopardy, you'd be in a lot of trouble. And so somebody, a fairly conservative guy, was messaging me saying, you know, why isn't the press covering this stuff? Daniela, what do you think about that? I mean, are we sort of falling down on the – I mean, these are real elections. They may be incredible long shots, but they're real elections.
Of course, and they will get coverage. I mean, we're what two, 3 weeks after Labor Day? I don't remember. You know, and that's traditionally when the attention starts to focus on all the races. But, you know, look, the governor's race is, you know, it kind of sucks all the air out of the room. I mean, it's a big deal and, you know, there are big issues at stake. I mean, you might argue we haven't covered the lieutenant governor's race enough, certainly post the primary. That's another constitutional office that's kind of, you know, fallen by the wayside just a little bit. So, you know, probably the guy's right. Guilty as charged. But, you know, it is still early, and I know we will be writing about these races.
I know the Connecticut Mirror is going to cover these races.
The Mirror will cover these races, but the person who wrote in or called in is correct. I mean, I look back 26 years ago when I started, a lot of the under-ticket races and smaller newspapers, mid-sized newspapers, other news organizations, they'd go to younger reporters, municipal reporters. Every news organization has shrunk, and that is one of the areas that's paid the price. And it is too bad because you used to be able to find even the under-ticket candidate's local paper would profile them. A weekly newspaper would. You're not seeing that now.
Yeah, but we will definitely be writing about these under-ticket races. And there's some interesting people. I mean, Peter Lumage has a great story. You know, he's just an interesting guy. Westby, too, you know, military background. I mean, he's run for races in the past. I think he ran for Congress.
He did something last cycle. I think he ran for something.
Yeah. So, you know, their stories will get told for sure.
I think in particular, we just saw, I think it may be mainly an online right now, Peter Lumage ad. I think he is going to make a very aggressive run for Secretary of State. And I think one of the arguments they're going to make is, yeah, well, look, we don't have a lot of money to run these races, but where's our unpaid media?
Right.
Where's the media coverage?
And don't get me wrong, they get coverage at the convention in May. They get coverage usually, like Daniela points out, some type of a profile just before the election. It's the amount in between. The sandwich is getting smaller and smaller.
Another reason to look at these things, too, is let's imagine that in his dark, dark moments that you are alluding to in the transportation forum, Dan Malloy has a point. I mean, he's down 6 or 7 polls, points in some polls, a little bit better in some others. But, you know, it's possible to imagine a world without Dan Malloy, as horrible as that might be for him to think about. many of the people who are players in these races would then become candidates. I mean, we have to, I think, automatically assume that George Shepson would run for governor 4 years from now if Dan Malloy were to lose this time. So some of these people who are in these under-ticket races right now are going to be interesting to watch in the years to come. Whether Dan Malloy loses or maybe Dan Malloy decides 2 terms are enough. You're looking at the benches of both parties with these under-ticket races anyway. This is kind of who they've got, for better or worse. Very quickly here, because we're a little bit running out of time, I want to just steer over, I very carefully made sure that Keith Faniff wouldn't have more than 4 minutes to talk about baseball, because it would be a disaster otherwise. So we've been following, obviously, the desire of the city of Hartford, the plans by the city of Hartford to build a baseball stadium. It's now turned into sort of a much larger development project. So in the Hartford Current today, we have some reporting about how the financials work on this. They seem a little blue sky-ish, generally speaking. But one of the things about them is that they're all predicated on this 25-year lease that is a performing lease for 25 years. And then when the lease is over, 5 more years of basically rent-free ownership of – or rent-free use for the city of Hartford of this stadium, which, you know, it sort of implies a period of great stability and a predictable set of 30 years, Keith Faniff. But the other news that came out this morning is that the Minnesota Twins, who are the allies of the New Britain Rock Cats, have actually severed that agreement, although they're leaving the possibility open after they looked around at all their options of re-signing up with the New Britain Rock Cats. But that's a lot of instability to suddenly introduce into this conversation.
That is – it is par for the course, though, if you follow minor league baseball. Major league franchises change minor league affiliates like dance partners. You will find 1 year after the San Francisco Giants pulled out of Norwich, the Detroit Tigers moved a team in there. Generally, if you have a quality facility, people will come. And I suspect the Minnesota Twins, who are the parent organization for the New Britain Rock Cats, have other options around the country where they can move a AA franchise, even if it's for just 1 year, and then come back to Hartford.
So you think about the people for whom this is a problem. The first group of people for whom this is a problem are the Solomons, who own the New Britain Rock Cats. And so – and it's important to remember or to consider the fact that these minor league affiliates, if they are affiliated with an MLB team, the MLB team pays almost for everything. I mean, they pay player salaries and trainer salaries and manager salaries and coach salaries. So that stream of money from the Twins, if it were absent from this franchise, would be – I mean, it would be hard for the Solomons to go a year without that money.
I would agree. That would be where the problem. It wouldn't be really a problem for the Twins. I have no doubt there are probably – there might even be other locations in the Eastern League.
No, I don't think there's anything open. They have to go south, I think.
Well, there are two other AA leagues. There's a Texas League and there's a Southern League. So there would be two other options.
Yeah, I think there are at least two franchises in each one of those leagues that do not currently have their affiliations settled. But there's that. And then it's also it may be a problem for Aaron Stewart, the mayor of New Britain, right? I mean, that team needs to be able to perform there at least for one more season and maybe even two, depending on how construction goes in New Britain. So that's not good news for New Britain that in the last year or so of their relationship with the Rock Cats, things would be limping along.
No, but I mean, I think she wanted to show she was taking a harder line with the team. So I don't know how much blowback she actually gets on that in local politics. I mean, the people will miss it. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, they kind of – I think some people already felt like, oh, they were getting betrayed.
Yeah. So anyways, what the Twins seem to be saying is this looks like kind of an unstable situation. We're going to look around and see if we can find a more stable situation. But maybe we'll just come back. Maybe we'll come back to our old girlfriend after we've dated around a bit. So more details to come about that. Thanks to the fabulous Tucker Ives and the beautiful Lydia Brown and our wonderful interns for helping out today, our friends at CTN, and especially thanks to Keith Faniff and Daniela Altamari, busy journalists who took time to visit the Wheelhouse. But who wouldn't visit the Wheelhouse given a chance? Good luck to John Dankosky.